Hey, Avani Dias with you for the Hack Podcast. It seems like you could make a lot of money making porn, right? Well, on this episode, you're going to hear from people in the industry who are struggling to make ends meet.
Porn used to be this big, like, multi-$1,000 setup. You'd have 20 people in the room filming you from any angle, but now it's really evolved.
It's day three of our Porn Week and you're going to find out what it's like to be a performer in the industry. Plus, do you get food delivered to you by writers? A huge case is looking at whether they've been underpaid and they say they're being exploited.
Hack, where we have a genuine technical advantage and that genuine technical advantage has a military application. That technology should be kept for Australia.
On Triple J.
If you're a uni student, it seems kind of far-fetched that your data could end up in the hands of foreign governments. Well, experts say attacks on our unis are becoming more and more common, so the government's cracking down. And there's been a lot of concern lately about China's influence on your unis. You've probably heard about it. There have been pro-China protests over the last few weeks to education centres on campuses, to questionable academic projects. Is this something we should all be worrying about? Shalila Medora has more.
Hey, remember this?
The ANU believes hundreds of thousands of staff and students are affected by the cyber attack.
20 years worth of data from students and staff at the ANU was hacked back in June. And it wasn't the first time.
Last July, ANU revealed Chinese hackers had accessed its system months earlier, but didn't believe any data was stolen.
According to the latest advice from the Australian Cybersecurity Centre, the targeting of Australian universities continues to increase.
Federal Education Minister Dan Tehan wants to stop all that.
We will establish a University Foreign Interference Task Force comprised of representatives from universities, national security organisations, and the Department of Education.
President of the National Union of Students, Desiree Kai, welcomes the creation of the Cybersecurity Task Force.
Students are really concerned that their personal and private data might be out there and, you know, able to be hacked.
The task force will have a particular focus on protecting Australian research from foreign governments that might not have our best interests in mind. The subtext to all of this? China. Last month, pro-China protesters clashed with fellow students who were demonstrating in support of Hong Kong remaining independent. And there's growing concern about how Chinese government-funded Confucius Institutes may be suppressing anti-Communist Party sentiment.
Well, many MPs have a concern about Australian university campuses and whether they're both a bastion of free speech that they need to be, and, of course, the influence of foreign governments over protest.
But let's peel the onion back even further. A lot of why this is a big deal comes down to cash. Chinese students make up the largest group of international students in Australia. According to Austrade, there are 200,000 of them here, and they contribute $14 billion to our economy.
I have been in Australia for 5 years.
People like Tippy.
We as international students on campus are here to study and receive education. We go to classes and our family back in China. They make huge sacrifices to support us through very expensive tuition fee.
Tippy's noticed a change in the way international students like herself have been received. She puts that down to anti-China sentiment.
It sends off a very unwelcoming attitude towards international students here because they used to understand Australia as a very multicultural society that's very welcoming to international students and immigrants. But now what's going on in the news is just completely the opposite.
Do you think that it's going to make people think twice about coming to Australia?
Of course they will.
That would be a huge problem for universities. You see, the federal government froze funding for domestic university spots back in 2017. So if unis want to grow, they have to look elsewhere for the cash. International students are a huge source of that revenue. Desiree says making Australia a less desirable place to study could end up impacting the quality of our universities.
You know, there's this wider issue where universities are being increasingly run like businesses and corporatised, and that's really a result of the federal government cutting funding for universities.
Hack. Triple J.
Shalala Maduro with that story. And are you a university student? Are you concerned about China's influence on your campus? Shoot me a text, 0439 757 555, especially if you're a Chinese student. The Federal Education Minister, Dan Tehan, is with us now to talk about what this means for you. Minister, for years on universities, there have been Confucius Institutes, Chinese student associations. We've covered pro-democracy protests happening over the past few weeks too. Is this policy too little too late? Isn't there already foreign interference on universities?
No, this isn't policy that's too little or too late. What this is the government basically collaborating with the university sector to put in place best practice guidelines when it comes to foreign interference, so that we're very clear about what the requirements are, and to make sure that we've got close cooperation between government agencies and the university sector. And I must commend the university sector and the vice chancellors for the way they've engaged on this issue.
Is this directed at Chinese interference in particular?
This isn't directed at any one country. This is us putting in place best practice guidelines for all countries to make sure that in the end what we're doing is protecting Australia's national interests where we need to be. Now, it won't be everywhere. We have very good and close collaboration with countries right across the world, and we do some outstanding research, which is beneficial.
Minister, there has been a lot of concern in your government about Chinese interference at unis, though. Several people have been outspoken from your party, and the Sydney Uni Vice-Chancellor has said that's moving us towards a wide Australia policy sentiment. Is that a concern for you?
Well, it's one of the most important things that we have in Australia is the ability for everyone to contribute to a national debate. What I need to do as Education Minister is making sure that we're putting in place the best policies that are going to protect a sector which is incredibly valuable to our nation.
Sure, and but we just heard from Chinese students who are saying they don't feel welcome here because of policies like this. What do you say to Chinese students listening? Are they welcome?
Absolutely, they're welcome. And I think I would speak for every vice chancellor around the nation in saying that we welcome international students. They make up an important mix of our universities. And you know, one of the things that I've always said is we should be incredibly proud as a nation that it's likely we'll surpass the UK as the second most popular destination for international students globally.
That is true, Minister. And we do rely on
institutions that we have.
We do rely on those students for a lot of funding. Chinese students in particular contribute $14 billion to the economy. Are we relying too much on them to make unis sustainable?
No, we're not. And one of the things that you know all universities do as autonomous organisations is make sure that any investment that they're getting, whether it be from international students or whether it be from the Australian taxpayer, that money is being put into good use, and that they're making sure that they're looking after their balance sheets to make sure they're looking after their net assets. And universities know their responsibilities. They have governing councils, and everything that I'm seeing from the universities that I go and visit is that they're well aware of their responsibilities, and they're using the revenue that they get from international students very wisely.
Okay, Dan Tehan, Federal Education Minister, thank you so much for coming on Hack. A lot of text coming in. Yes, 100%. We should be worried about Chinese infiltration on our soil. This is Australia. This is a multicultural society, not a pro-communist one. Another person, I feel really sorry for the international students that are accepted to Aussie unis when they obviously don't have the English skills to study at a tertiary standard.
Hack. I contacted Deliveroo and they weren't interested in hearing what I was talking about. They fogged me off. The only next step was to start a legal case.
On Triple J.
What are you getting for dinner tonight? If you get home late, can't be bothered cooking, then you open up a food delivery app and dinner's on the way. It's a pretty easy situation. But there are downsides to these kinds of services, and workers are saying they're being exploited. One former delivery rider is now suing his former employer, Deliveroo. And John O'Hare's been looking into this story.
I reckon most of us are occasionally guilty of it. After a few too many the night before and post the 2 p.m. transition from bed to the couch, You reach for your phone and via a food delivery service, order a big old dirty feed. But is your double cheeseburger with extra cheese sauce and a side of chicken wings worth it if the person delivering it is being exploited?
In my view, it's sham contracting. It's all a sort of facade to enable the underpayment and the wage theft.
Meet Jeremy Ryan. He's an ex-Deliveroo rider. He worked for that company for a little extra pocket money doing an occasional shift. He says when it was busy, he would earn above minimum wage. But here's the thing. It wasn't always busy.
I knew it was a low-paying, entry-level job, but after doing my sums and adding up all my payslips for the year, it was extremely low, a lot lower than I thought, and I didn't realise how illegally low the wages were. On average, overall, across the whole year, I averaged out about $10.50 an hour, and that worked out to be about half of minimum wage.
Jeremy is now suing Deliveroo.
In the legal case, which I've submitted to the Federal Circuit Court, I'm requesting that the salary and the wages be brought up to what they legally should be. So what that'll mean in effect is the pay will be retrospectively amended and fixed to be what it legally should have been. So in effect, that will be back pay.
Now, if all this sounds familiar, that's because it's kind of happened before with another company, Foodora, which has since shut down. The Fair Work Commission found it had unfairly dismissed a rider who publicly raised concerns about wages. But the FWC also made another finding, and this is the important bit, so listen up. It found Foodora's delivery riders were in fact employees due to the company's high degree of control over them. But riders were being incorrectly classified as independent contractors, which meant Foodora didn't need to pay entitlements.
The Foodora case was really important. That case showed that despite Foodora saying to Lowe black and blue in the face that these workers were independent contractors, the court differed. The court said, no, they're under a great level of control, they're employees, and they should have the rights that employees are entitled to. And this delivery case looks to us to be exactly the same.
That's Michael Kane from the Transport Workers Union, who believes the Foodora case set a precedent. The TWU is backing Jeremy's case.
And I think it's on the back of this mythology that these new economy operators have built up. They've built up this mythology that to have flexible work arrangements, you have to be an independent contractor. But nothing could be further from the truth. Really, what these companies are saying in desperation is that they want to be able to rip off workers. They want to avoid all of those things that have made Australian working life great. And they're doing it all under this guise of flexibility. It's a ruse, it's a sham, and we have to stop it now.
We contacted Deliveroo about this story. It sent through an official three-line statement which read,
on average, Deliveroo riders in Australia work 15 hours a week, earning over $22 per hour on average, fitting riding around study, hobbies, caring responsibilities or other work. We will always defend riders' ability to choose to work this way.
Its PR team also provided a two-page document titled Backgrounder for Journalists, which included this. The nature of riders' work is unlike any other form of employment. You can't make a new world fit into an old model.
Hack on Triple J.
John O'Hare with that story, and a few people saying that this was the rider's choice to take on the job. That's the text that's come in from Tommy from the Sunshine Coast. And another person says, so he gladly accepted all the benefits of the gig, like doing whatever the hell he wants when not delivering, but also wants to be paid for all that time.
Hacks Porn Week.
I can make at least like 10 grand off my Snapchat alone in 1 month, which is insane.
On Triple J.
All right, all this week we've been telling you about porn. 71% of you watch it, according to our What's Up in Your World survey, but only a tiny 2% of you pay for porn. So what does that mean for the performers inside your computer screens? This month, the really famous porn star Mia Khalifa said she only made $12,000 in her entire career, and she's one of the most popular porn stars in the world. Tim Swanston spoke to a whole bunch of porn performers about how they get by.
I started dating this girl who used to escort, and after a year or so of dating, she decided to quit her day job and go back to escorting, and you know what? While she was at it, why not get into porn? And then I thought, well, I don't like working in a bank anymore, so I'm going to do the same thing.
That's Ryan James. He's certainly one of the more popular Aussie porn stars around and has a surprisingly nonchalant story about getting into the sex on screen biz. I'm chatting to him at this year's Sexpo.
The Australian porn scene is quite small. When I started, there were around half a dozen companies, and there was a decent amount of work, but by no means enough to live on. Everyone else that made porn in Australia at that time had other jobs.
He reckons almost everyone in porn has a side gig, even if it's something else in the adult industry. Ryan makes most of his money escorting and says in the 6 years since he fell into porn, it's changed in a really big way.
These days, there aren't as many companies and they don't seem to be filming as much. There are only a few companies around that seem to be doing okay.
So why is the economics of porn changing? Basically, because of the internet. Porn naturally used to work a lot like the film industry. People generally would access content through VHS stores, but maybe not as well lit and a bit stickier. Now, in the same way that the film industry has to deal with pirated content being available online, so too do porn production companies. And that's really eating away at their bottom line.
Porn used to be this big, like, multi-$1,000 setup. You'd have 20 people in the room filming you from any angle, but now it's really evolved.
That's performer and sex worker Harley Smith. She says the way performers have adapted to these changes is by shooting and making their own explicit content.
And it's something that you can, like, grab a camera and a microphone and do from the comfort of your own home. You can film, like, this scene 50 times and edit it yourself these days with the way software and technology is evolving.
And if you want to work with other performers or are looking to make a higher quality product, people are increasingly doing what's known as a content exchange or content trade. Here's Kiara Edwards. She's been making a lot of self-produced porn for a year now.
Most of the time we all do it by ourselves. So we organise or we share the price of a videographer, and then we all get the content and then we edit it the way that we want. So we end up with different content, but the same video kind of thing.
But why wouldn't you just shoot for a big mainstream company rather than go through all this rigmarole?
With a lot of those engagements, you get paid a certain amount and the company owns the content and the company distributes the content. So you get one paycheck and that's it.
That's Aussie performer and producer Stuck at Zero. He says rather than get a paycheck of between $150 to $1,000 for a scene, it's probably more profitable to shoot your own stuff and own the content yourself.
When you create content, you're creating a product that sits on the shelf that can be resold. So you can sell that to 100 people, 500 people. And if it doesn't date, then it can last you for 3, 4, 5 years of just sitting on the shelf selling to new fans and new people that find you.
And American porn star Kendra Sunderland totally agrees. And just FYI, she's kind of a big deal. She was in town promoting a sex toy modelled off her own vagina.
I feel like a lot of girls these days just do movies to get their name out there, because you only get paid once. And it doesn't matter how many people see it, but when you do your own thing, you get paid per person. So I feel like a lot of girls are starting to realize that's definitely the better way to go as far as making the most money.
That's what she's doing, and by Jesus, she's bringing home the bacon.
It makes it way easier to get by. It's like I can make at least like 10 grand off my Snapchat alone in 1 month, which is insane. So
okay, so you've shot your content, but how do you push it out? And how do you get paid? At this point, the porn distribution world is kind of your oyster. Many vids, OnlyFans, premium Snapchat, even messaging services like Kick Messenger and Telegram. Some of them will usually take a cut, either of your direct sales or of your subscription fee people pay to access your content. As for the big free websites, a huge number of the most popular ones like Pornhub, RedTube and YouPorn are all owned by MindGeek. Performers say there's a really strong chance the stuff you shoot and make available to your fans will end up on some of the big, popular free websites. And even though you own the content, Harley says it's a tough process to get it taken down.
If you want to file a DMCA...
The Digital Millennium Copyright Act. It's used to get stuff taken down that you own.
You have to file it with your legal name. You have to kind of expose yourself to the site that's hosting it, your personal identity, to get that content taken down.
Porn Week on Hack.
Tim Swanston with that story. And what has that made you think about your porn use? Are you rethinking whether you should pay for it now? Give me a call, 1300 055 36. Someone's tweeted at us on the Triple J Hack Twitter. Porn reporting has been very heterocentric this week. Well, we are going to focus on the experiences of LGBTIQ people tomorrow and how they often use porn to learn about sex. Another person's texted in saying $12,000 is conveniently the amount you have to start filing taxes, which is pretty funny. That person's relating to Mia Khalifa, who's one of the biggest porn stars in the world, and has said that that's all she made in her whole career. And another texter, as it is porn week, but also equal pay day, how come no one's discussing the discrepancy in pay between female and male performers? That's a really good point. Porn performers are struggling, but I wonder who is making the money here if basically no one's paying for porn. Professor Alan McKee's with us. He's from the University of Technology, Sydney, and he's researched the porn industry extensively. Professor McKee, thank you for coming on Hack. Are you surprised porn stars are turning to other industries to get by?
It's important that when we're thinking about pornography, we don't think about it in isolation and try and judge what is life like in pornography compared to some abstract ideal of what the perfect job would be like. We have to consider pornography in relation to other kinds of work, and particularly in relation to other work in the creative industries. And when I did some research on this, what I found is that being a porn star is not at all different from other kinds of work in the creative industries, and particularly other kinds of performance work in the creative industries. So one of the things you find is that whether you are a musician or an actress or you appear in pornography, it's the producers who make the money. And that's not new. That's not something that has been brought about by digital disruption. That is historically the way in which the creative industries have functioned. And so if you want to make money in pornography, you go into producing. And that is generally the case. Creatives, the people who are called creative in the creative industries, mostly lack creative control and mostly do not make lots of money. You have a tiny number of actors, for example, who become stars, but the vast majority of them scrape along, do a little bit of work. They work as extras, for example, where they're absolutely powerless and treated as objects and make very little money out of it. So the fact that people are moving into the producing side in pornography makes perfect sense. What's changing and what's interesting is that digital disruption makes it easier to become a producer.
So when you say producer, sorry to cut you off there, do you mean people who own these companies and then distribute the films, or do you mean filmmakers, camera operators? Can you break that down?
So in the creative industries, the producer is the person who owns, distributes the property. They're the person who come up with the idea, who identifies the audience, who gets the finance, who, if we're going to be classically Marxist about this, people who own the means of production. And so in pornography, in the old days, as in Hollywood, there were a very small number of people who could actually have the equipment that would let you make something and the means of distribution that would get it to an audience so you could actually get money for it. What's happened now with digital disruption is that that model has been completely disrupted. And so all that you need in order to become a producer is a means of filming and a means of distribution. The problem then becomes about getting eyeballs and monetizing it. And that's what's really interesting is the new business models, whether that's things like piggy bank girls or cam girl work, that lets a lot more people be not just the performers in the films, but also the ones who are making revenue from it.
This week we've been covering porn and we've been hearing a lot about the rise in free pornography on the internet, the major sites like Pornhub and so on distributing it. But what you seem to be saying, I guess, is that that makes it more accessible for anyone to become a porn producer and therefore make money off it?
Well, the challenge is the getting the eyeballs. Anybody can distribute porn now. You can create a video of yourself having sex and put that online. Anyone can do that. How do you monetize that then becomes the problem. And there is no question that there is a massive problem with piracy and with unethical distribution. So what that needs is, what that drives people towards is different forms of different ways of monetizing that. And some of the ways that happens is through live cam performances, which retain a sense of the aura that isn't quite the same as when you have that videoed and then pirated for free, that isn't quite the same as the live performance, which again is very similar to what's happening in the other creative industries, where music, for example, there is much less money made now from the music, and what the money is made from is the live touring and the merchandising associated with that. So it becomes about selling what, and I keep seem to falling into the old cultural theories here, what Walter Benjamin used to call the aura, sense of being at a live performance where you're engaging with a performer. So the live cams allow that to happen. But also there are ways in which performers and producers are monetizing their production through aiming for niche audiences, through freemium content. Again, very similar things to what's happening in other parts of the creative industries.
And it's interesting what you're saying, Alan, about, I guess, thinking about working in porn aside from the sex, but like any other job. I mean, are there concerning aspects to the way that the industry's going with all these DIY films and so on? Is it exploiting anyone in the equation?
What you see is different in the pornography industry is two things. One is stigma. And it is, the point is commonly made that if you work in pornography, that can damage your possibilities for future careers, which is not a problem with pornography, that's a problem with bigotry. So the problem there is that we need to get rid of people's prejudice against sex workers. And secondly, workplace health and safety for sex workers. And we've seen this in arguments around decriminalization for sex work. So long as the conditions on porn sets are seen as a moral issue rather than as a workplace health and safety issue, then workplace health and safety is pushed out of the equation in ways that simply would not be acceptable in other industries.
There's a common consensus that people who work in porn are quite vulnerable, that they're being exploited in the industry, that they're struggling and forced into it. What do you say to people who think that?
There is a fantastic academic article, and what the team of researchers did was they surveyed 177 pornography actresses, and then they compared that to a matched sample of 177 women who were not in pornography, matched on age, ethnicity, and marital status. And what they found was that pornography actresses enjoyed sex more than the match sample. There was no more incidence of child sexual abuse. The pornography actresses had higher levels of self-esteem, positive feelings towards themselves, social support, sexual satisfaction, and spirituality compared to the women who were not pornography actresses. It kind of makes sense when you follow some porn actresses on Twitter and see the ways in which they make sense of themselves and their lives and their careers, but it doesn't fit in with the urban myth at all.
Definitely given us a lot to think about there. Professor Alan McKee, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Hacks Porn Week on Triple J.
That's Professor Alan McKee, who's researched the porn industry really extensively. Joel from Hornsby's called in. Do you pay for porn?
No, I haven't for a long time, since the internet, I guess.
How come?
And well, it's just free now, isn't it? I don't really see, like, I don't personally need to pay for it.
We just heard from all these porn performers who are saying they're struggling to get by. Does that make you feel bad about it?
Not really. I don't think that people get into pornography for healthy reasons. And I feel like porn in general has become like a necessary evil for most people. It doesn't really benefit people.
Do you think we should be breaking down that stigma, though, and sort of seeing this as just any other job?
Well, that's the thing. If they want it to be like any other job, then this is, it sort of becomes an argument against how much they should be paid for it. I don't know. I think it's sort of a muddy area. I don't think our society would really lose anything if pornography disappeared.
Oh, so, I feel like a lot of people, 71% of the Triple J audience may be pretty freaked out by you saying that, Joel, but thanks heaps for the call.
Hack on Triple J.
Thanks heaps for listening to the podcast. I hope you can tune into more of our Porn Week coverage, and we'll have all the other big news stories as well. I'll catch you later.